Welcome to Thing Making, an audio podcast for, about, and by people who make things. So, today on Thing Making, I'm talking with Dan Garonzi, who is puppeteer, puppet maker, performer, many, many things. She has a busy, busy life, I think, teaching puppetry, performing, touring. So tell us, Dan, what was the last project you have done?
I have just got back from touring, and it's a couple of projects that are linked together. So I've created a small venue inside a caravan where I've gutted a 1980s caravan to turn into a venue. And then I've made a show for In the Caravan. So it's kind of done its first tour and its first show. It's, taken a show on tour. And, we took three shows. But the puppet show that I took was called Destination Home. And it's a one-woman show with a cast of about 30. And that's because I have nearly 30 disembodied heads that become the other characters and the landscape and the global community,
okay.
I suppose.
And what are the disembodied heads made out of?
They're papier-mâché.
Papier-mâché heads.
Yeah.
Okay. And they represent communities?
Yeah, they become characters, and they, you know, one of them is me as well, and my partner is one of them.
Right.
And then they become other characters from around the world, and yeah, they also become our community, and they become landscape, and they become, you know, so each of them is individual. So I had three clay heads going at any one time, and I'd mâché them, and then after I cut them off, I'd change the features a bit, like I'd change their location or things like that, and then re paper mâché them, and they have it. They range from like white through to black. So they've got quite a gamut of skin tones in there.
Okay. Yeah. And so it was a really intimate show.
Yeah.
So how many people in the audience?
13.
So how was it received?
Really well.
Yeah, you took it to Adelaide Festival?
Yeah, to Adelaide Fringe. So we did an initial season at Melbourne Fringe, and then we redeveloped and we did Midsummer Festival and then 3 weeks in Adelaide Fringe. It was received really well. Like, people would stay to talk about their own experiences. It's about housing and the search for housing and the insecurity around housing, of the world, and so people would stay and talk about either their own experience or the experience sometimes of their parent or the experience of their clients or that kind of thing, and because there's a lot of lines of inquiry within the show. People responded to lots of different things in there and liked to hang out and talk about it.
Yeah, good. It's a really topical issue, I think, with global migration.
Oh, yeah,
refugee,
totally.
Asylum seekers, but just rental housing costs in Australia, in the major cities in Australia as well.
Yeah.
And you, for you personally, I think. And And so with the, just with getting back to those puppets as well, with the range of skin tones, it's interesting to hear that kind of thing because, you know, puppets can be anything and any skin tone. And so it's quite refreshing because often I think what we see still, even though puppets can be anything, they still often follow a really quite restricted, stereotypical model in terms of skin tone or gender.
Yeah.
And so was that a deliberate thing?
Yes. I wanted to use, although the story is kind of grounded in my character's search for a rental house, I wanted to be able to look at a wider global problem. But I didn't want to personally be telling the story of someone else. Like, I'm not Sudanese, and I really can't imagine what it must be like to be a Sudanese refugee, say, or an Aboriginal, Australian Aboriginal person being kicked off their community in Western Australia, or things like that. You know, I'm not fleeing from domestic violence, but I wanted those characters to be present, and also by having them, the decision to have them just as heads meant they were headlines. Like, so during part of the show, sometimes I'd pick up different ones and different news stories would come out. And so I was kind of working with the fact that even though I know that all these things are happening in the world, I only get really small snippets. Yeah. And the complex realities of people's situations are not necessarily my experience. But I really, I felt it was really important for those things to be there.
To have a voice. And because when you picked up those heads, they were connected to sound.
Yes.
That was operated live.
Yes.
And the sound was snippets of news.
Of news stories. Yeah.
And so getting back to just the puppets and the material that you were using with papier-mâché, is that something that you do a lot of, or was it a new thing for you?
No, that was
papier-mâché?
I really like papier-mâché, and those heads in particular were were largely made out of rental housing applications or things like that I'd kept from my long rental history.
That's
ongoing.
So because they were made out of, I'm just interested in that to tease that out a little bit further. Because they were made out of those rental applications that some obviously unsuccessful. I just wonder how much that goes into the actual puppet and the feeling for you when you were operating that puppet, knowing that the material that you used was related to the content of the show. Do you think it all adds up? Because the audience don't see that they're made out of rental applications, but you know that. Do you think as a puppeteer, performer, it makes a difference?
Yeah, for me it does.
How?
I don't really know how to explain that. There's something about embedding content into work that, even if it's quite subtle, I find really satisfying as the maker of the work. And so those had a lot of rental applications. And then I also have this really old medical text book that I use for papier-mâché whenever I'm making people. And it's like, and so all, it's like goes into, you know, really high detail of how the body works. And there's something about that for me that's about using that that's really humanizing. And that's might only be in my head, and no one would necessarily ever know that that's what's happening. But I suppose that's part of my making ritual.
Right.
It's like being mindful of what's going in.
Yes. I think you're not alone in that. I think it's something that as audiences don't necessarily know unless you put it in the program notes. But I've done a similar thing with making, and often I think we're putting this detail in that the audience aren't necessarily going to see. But it all adds layers of meaning. And that, I think, I don't know. I mean, there's been no scientific tests on whether or not an audience, it makes a difference to the performance with or without those things. But if it makes a difference to you and you're the performer, you're the creator, then why not, you know? Yeah. And so what other materials have you been working with? Because I know that you've done a variety of different kinds of puppetry, with different sorts of communities and different people. Yeah. And you went to Japan. You've been all over the place with working with Polyglot. And they use paper and elastic and tape.
Everything.
So what sort of materials do you enjoy working with besides the papier-mâché?
Look, I really like everything. I suppose I'm more of your grassroots kind of maker. Like, I really like using bamboos and canes, and I like using paper and cardboard. And the project we did in Japan, we also took some Tyvek, which was really exciting to use because it just takes color so quickly and it's really easy. I like using materials that anyone could use.
Yeah,
and so especially with working with communities, I like to use materials that aren't high cost or are really toxic or hard to source for the community, so that they could, you know, so they could create a project themselves, or you know, that's kind of what I like from working with communities, that they can just take ownership. If someone wants to take ownership, they probably could do that. So I really like cardboard and found object. I love cane because you can be so huge. You know, you can just be so huge and light, and it's transformation is massive.
And do you think that when you work with different material, do you think that it kind of dictates a little bit more what you might do with that particular material? So wood, as opposed to cane or bamboo or paper, they all have different qualities.
Yeah.
Do you think that they kind of lead you in a different direction each time?
I think possibly. Possibly they help me have a little bit less control over the outcome. What I mean by that is, like, when I was making the head, say, so they were a clay sculpt.
Yeah.
And then the paper mache went on top. And so that was a, you know, it was quite controlled what the outcome of that head was going to be. And then, you know, the tissue paper or whatever colored it after. But when I work with cardboard, paper, bamboo, the Tyvek or something, there's a bit of or an organic process where you may think that it's going to look exactly like this, but the materials argue and a little bit will go where they think it's going to go, then informs character and that kind of thing. And I think that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Is that there's a little bit more of the materials having a say,
right?
Yeah.
Because they're more flexible.
Or they're more, you know, like with cane, it's like sometimes it's just not going to bend the way the way you want it to. And it ends up taking on a little bit of its own. And you can work to control it. But actually, I think sometimes the little kind of oddities or the how it's not symmetrical or whatever makes the puppet.
Yes.
Yeah, makes the piece amazing. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. And what are you working on in the future?
I'm split. I would like to I have two things. I have a very, very long time away thing. I would like to do a giant shadow work where the screen is above and the puppeteers are under and the audience is under. So I have a little thing that it's been percolating for maybe a couple of years now that I've started really thinking about that. And on a smaller scale, I'd also am working on trying to formulate what my next show inside the caravan is. So really intimate and really huge.
Really huge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And each have their challenges or their advantages as well.
Yeah.
When you go from one to another, I think it can be quite liberating to work quite large scale images and then quite beautiful to be so intimate.
Yeah.
Did you find when you were working intimately in the caravan that people did... you had more of a relationship with the audience because they're so close to you?
Yes, yeah, and I like that. I like making work where I meet everybody. You know, I like to either welcome people or say goodbye to them, and where I have to engage with them. I like that. And my last puppet work was a little erotic finger puppet show. And it was like it seated four people, And so myself and my performance partner would greet everyone and seat them and put them in the booth, and we could see them throughout the show. And I really like that exchange. It's like the wall. It's like clearly you're doing a performance and you are the performer, but there's something about removing that fourth wall that I find really challenging and really exciting as a performer. And I think with the caravan, the show, the Destination Home in the Caravan, the subject matter was quite serious, even though there was, you know, there was moments of lightness or you know, comedy or whatever. It challenges me to not assume people don't like it if they're not smiling, you know, because I can see everybody. I can see everybody. And it's such an interesting space to be in, where you don't know what people are going through. And I have, I suppose, like the first, when I did the development season, that really, like, trying not to respond to my assumption that people weren't liking it or weren't getting it because they looked quite serious themselves.
Right. Yeah.
And that was really great as a performer for me to notice. You know, because then those same people would come up to me afterwards and say, I really, you know, felt blah, 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 and would have an exchange with me about the show.
Right, yeah.
But I was seeing them go in my little head, like, while I'm performing. So clearly, you know, like, it's that line between actually being really connected and present in the work and being able to see people and part of your having to shut your brain off. But staying awake to people as well. It's such an interesting line, and I really like that territory. And while my brain's going,
while you're thinking,
are they going to sleep? I think that person's having a nap. You know? They're frowning.
What about your relationship with the puppets? Let's just chat about that a little bit more too, because, you know, puppeteers seem to have a different relationship, in my opinion, and my experience, with the object that they're working with, the found object or the material, while they're performing, than, say, maybe an actor does, or even a dancer does. Can you talk a little bit about your own experience of actually performing with the puppet, and the kind of relationships or the network of action and between, say, you, the audience, and the puppet?
Oh, wow. It's like your split personality, isn't it? Yeah, it's so interesting, because when I was learning to be an actor, you know, one of my acting teacher was very much like, you cannot be another person. You are always yourself, but you can perform, you can be present inside other people, you know, or take on all the information and then create something out of that. But she remembered having this thing. I remember her saying quite often, like, you know, you can't be someone else. You're not them, but all these skills create the tools for you to act, and then be present within that character. And the funny thing about puppets is I find that they have a life of their own so often, you know, and maybe that's from what I was saying before about the little oddities, or the, you know, that one's got a limp, or that one's got a, you know, you can almost never fix the limp, you know, and then that's the character, and it's
inherent in the material.
That's the puppet, and you can't alter them so much, you know, or something. And I think as a performer, they give you a bit of freedom. I feel like they tell you what they do.
Right.
They tell you what they do, and then you have to work with them and they can more easily navigate territories that the human body can't.
Yes.
And I think that's part of the magic, you know, and part of what makes them so appealing as a performance tool. And so you get to create so much complex and simple story and emotion and questions for an audience.
Yeah, it's a rich experience.
It's really rich and it doesn't take much. And I think it just gives me so much joy because you get to, it's like playing, you know. Like
discovering the character of this thing is.
So much discovery and what's possible. Yeah. Like the possibility becomes endless in a different way to when you are performing or acting with your own body or your own voice. Like you have a much bigger palette because they can go where the human body can't. And they can take an audience somewhere a bit gentler where the human body could possibly go but would call, you know, it's like, you know, I was talking about my erotic finger puppet show. The skin makes them look like people, like makes them really human and alive because it's the hands. And the subject matter was quite confronting, but something about it being puppets disarms people.
Yeah.
It was an adult show, but they were disarmed quite early, and then you can just hit them with some politics hit them with some, like, you know, some big questions that they weren't ready for, but, you know, so there's, I don't know, there's something that's quite safe. There's a safety that allows you to go places.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so because I'm interviewing people on thing making about new technologies, just to kind of find out a little bit about what puppeteers are doing and what their thoughts are on some of the new technologies that are around and whether or not they have embraced new technologies, and if they have, how, or if they haven't, why not? So can you talk a little bit about what new technologies you might have used in your work, and if not, why not?
My most recent work, Destination Home, when I initially wanted to make that work, I thought it was going to be me and one puppet and a video artist. And then just before the development started, the video artist had to pull out for, you know, reasons of her own. And then I couldn't find anyone that I liked who was available in the time that we had. So the project turned into something else. It turned into me and these heads instead, which is, you know, we're quite happy with. And that would have been my first time really working with...
Did you have thoughts about why you wanted to work with video technology?
I was interested in how you could create a space with nothing. I was interested in being in a small space and not wanting to have a lot of set.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to work on home, and I knew I wanted to investigate a global themes.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about how to do that. I'd never worked with a video artist before, so I was excited about that possibility and, you know, mapping and all that kind of thing. And, and I was interested in how the body... I was interested in being able to, create psychological landscape to work within. And I just wanted to play with that. Mm. So unfortunately that didn't happen, but, that's all right. That's another project. And I suppose the only thing we did use in that show is I used my mobile phone a lot. And I use my mobile phone as a phone and also as a light source. And then with, you know, the caravan is also, everything is operated wirelessly. So all the sound and lighting is wireless. But that's as far as I really have gone with new technologies as such. Why I haven't gone further with that is financially, I don't have like it costs a lot more.
Yeah, so funding, funding and artist fees, and then having to have the technology, which is, I suppose, you know, really excited about the project, those things don't matter.
Right.
So much, you know, like you go ahead and you go, oh, yeah, this is the thing, you know, and then you find the funding for it or you go through all that stuff. And as yet, and because my work seems to be getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and my, you know, I seem to be working more with tiny and intimate and creating small space work and paring back, like I'm trying to pare back cost and make myself a bit more self-sufficient and my career more viable as far as works that I produce, which is or isn't necessarily... I'm not necessarily being successful at. Yeah, so I keep on, and I'm a bit of a Luddite, I keep on going back to making, like, trying to look for new or interesting ways to use old ways.
Right,
yeah.
Traditional methods of puppet making and performing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a fusion, but, I haven't...
And so you're off to Brazil?
Yes.
Just before we finish, do you want to talk about what you're going to do in Brazil?
I'm going to Brazil with Polyglot Theatre, and we have two works going. We've built this city, which is a outdoor experiential play space for children and families, which is the other thing I love. I love, like, urban intervention, kind of like public art or public interventions. And the other thing we're doing is Ants, which is, I suppose, a puppet work, but it's also an urban intervention. And we are giant ants with big ant heads on our heads, and we have a little sound system on our chest. So each ant has its own little soundtrack that probably reaches about a meter around diameter around us. So it's very intimate soundtrack, and we can't speak, so we have little clickers in our fingers. We don't speak English or understand English or any other spoken language really, except clicking. And we have a couple of hundred giant crumbs, and it's like we go out and we don't engage with people at all, and through the non-engagement we engage with them quite closely and quite intimately. So we are task-based. And our task can change at any minute, but it's to move the crumbs. It's basically to get the crumbs and take them somewhere,
right,
and to just keep doing that. And through that game, children become ants. And so they start picking up the crumbs and they start bringing them, and they start passing them to you, or they arrange themselves into, like, we've got to take all these things, you know, they're constantly talking to each other, we've got to take them over there, auntie wants us to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And or they start their own, they'll take a crumb and they'll start something of their own, which we then pick up on and go and join there, you know. So it's a little bit like, it's if the children lead something, we go there. But and we talk through our fingers clicking, and one of the really exciting parts about that is that sometimes the children will start doing that back at us. They'll be like, and clicking their, right, you know, like doing their little fingers together the same as our clickers do.
So they're trying to communicate.
They will communicate with us in a new language. Yes, and once I had this one young boy who would have been about 5. Maybe a bit younger, translating. So I would click and he would say, Mr. Ant says we have to blah, blah, blah. And I'd click again. Oh, actually, he wants us to start just the brown ones. I love it. They just lead with their own imagination what's happening and go there, and we'll just go with that. And then often after the ants leave, the children will still be ants. They'll still be playing, you know, playing with the crumbs and taking them over here and putting them there and become the ants themselves. And I really love it because you can't stop for a photo. You can't, you know, as a roving thing, you know, you don't behave as a roving character normally does. There's no photo stopping. There's no talking. there's none of that. So yeah, it's really freeing as a performer, as a public performer, and I think it's also really freeing for the children. Like there's no instructions on how to behave. They just pick it up and go.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I wonder, I mean, you know, just to go back to what we were talking about with the puppet and the relationship with the puppet and the audience, I wonder how that kind of experience performing with the ants for you influences your work with adults and the intimate relationship you have in the caravan. Because as you were talking about earlier, you are very intimate in that caravan and you can see people not necessarily smiling, but it took you a while to realise that they're still engaging with the work and in their own way, thinking of their own housing stories or and so on. And so I'm just wondering if you've, you know, how that idea of the audience interacting, the kids interacting and making up a game or trying to communicate with you translate into an adult audience.
Look, one of the things that I've noticed is that children, I don't think this is going to answer your question, like the children don't so much need permission to engage generally. Adults often will try and place permission for children and themselves in engagement. And I think as performers, we can often underestimate the audience and their intelligence in that permissions. And this is why I don't think this is answering your question. I've gone off on a little tangent.
That's okay. Talk about that.
Something that this, and this is a lot of polyglots work specifically, but also some of my own work that's more interactive or participatory in some manner. Ants is really, really wonderful in showing that children will automatically just go to participate in a lot of situations, and they'll just, if left to their own device, they'll just kind of work it out, and they might ask what should they do, but they'll just keep going. Often parents will hold the children back till they know what they're supposed to do. Till they know what the child is supposed to do, and wait for permission or ask for permission or need there to be some kind of right or wrong in the engagement. Whereas children are more just like see what happens and then go for it. Adults are really funny because even if you give them permission, they'll still check in again. I'm still like, in a really general way,
so adults need a bit more permission from the performers to engage with the puppets.
Yeah, to a degree, I think, but I don't want to give them it. I want them to have to just get over that step. So that's what I mean by like I think we underestimate. Mm. Audiences sometimes and can like spoon feed them a little bit into so it's a fine line between making something inspiring people to engage and making it safe enough for people to engage or for sparking the question to engage in, especially if it's participatory, without having to like hold their hand and step them through the process.
Yeah.
And I think like that's what I mean by, I think we can underestimate people. And I think that then feeds more, you know, if we underestimate an audience too much, then their expectation next time is that they'll be spoon fed and then on it, you know. So we create a culture of people needing to be really clearly invited in.
So you're kind of putting a stop to that by not actively inviting them to participate. But I think puppets kind of have a license in a way to activate the experience of wonder in the viewer, whether they're an adult or a child.
Yeah.
Just the fact that there's a puppet there, we know it's not real, so we're already asking our audiences to believe that it's real or that it's active or animated when they know it isn't. So we have a little bit of a license to sure. have that leeway, I think.
Yeah, sure. And I think, like, you know, like, I love those kids who are like, you know, I did this big dinosaur puppet, one of the earth dinosaurs that's at the museum, where you're totally enclosed and it's, you know, it's got a little effects on its on your voice, so it's, you know, it's so realistic and wonderful. And you know those children that are kind of like edging away and yeah. trying to kind of hide behind an adult going, it's not real, it's not real, it's not real, it's not even real, but like, but they're so unsure. So it's like, you know, children, yeah, like children will just go there in a yeah. different way to adults. Whereas yeah. adults will set it, yeah, adults will often be like, oh, look at the scary ant. So then their kid is scared of the ant, you know, right. It's like, instead of, oh, what's the ant do? You know, it's that setup, something about the setup, you know, I don't know. Yeah. Like, as far as audience, how audience participate in different things. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I think adults' responses to puppets, like on the street anyway, like roving puppets or things like that, is
different.
It's very it's different, and often I think having the, you know, if you're in a suit, having the person removed, having the human that's in the puppet removed, kind of can, you know, it's like when people go and kick over a puppet from behind, you know, it's like, would you do that to a person who's standing there? It's like something about covering the person means that it's okay to like push over someone who's in
yeah,
a okay. big massive suit, you know, but I don't think any of that answers any of your questions necessarily.
But I have to say thank you so much for talking with me, and good luck with all your future projects.
Thank you very much, Lynn.